This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Serena Locke with you. Thanks for joining me and the team for a trip around a big country. This week, farmers from rural Bougainville are meeting the chocolate makers, turning their cocoa beans into a premium product. We visit a community garden that's cultivating friendships, as well as a thriving veggie patch. Find out how physical challenges like rock climbing and abseiling are helping injured soldiers. And we'll meet scientists scaling heights to measure forest health.
Most of the time, the plants that I want to look at, the epiphytes, so the ferns and the orchids, are growing right up into the crown of the tree. So I need to climb up as high as possible to be able to see these species.
Climbing trees for scientific research, it's a job that used to be done by trained monkeys. Now the scientists themselves are getting strapped into harnesses and hanging from ropes above the forest. That's coming up. Let's start with a chocolate tasting. Artisanal Australian chocolate makers have been working with the best cocoa growers of Bougainville to transform bean to bar.
Let's go to the chocolate table quickly. Which one do you want to try?
Yeah, let's go to the Bougainville ones.
Yeah. So this is chocolate from Bougainville. What do you think it tastes like?
It's like a bit of it's sour.
Steve Savaker is tasting chocolate made from cocoa beans grown by himself and his partner Elizabeth at their block in rural Bougainville for the very first time.
That chocolate you're eating there is made from 72% beans from your farm. Can you taste your beans in it?
It's quite a different. The percentage over there is the same as mine.
Yeah.
But when you taste it, it will be a different. You know, the different environment we come from. I'll give you an example. A man from central Bougainville grows his own cocoa on top of the minerals. And a man from the north grows his cocoa from on top of corals, you know.
Yeah.
And we South Bougainvilleans, we grow our cocoa on top of the soil. There's no minerals, no nothing whatsoever. So that's the way I see how it tastes.
So you reckon yours tastes the best, the South Bougainville?
That's it.
Hello, I'm Anthony Stewart. I've come to meet Steve at a small chocolate factory in Melbourne. He's come to Australia after winning first prize in Bougainville's annual chocolate festival, and he's here meeting chocolate makers who've used his beans to produce premium artisanal chocolate.
I have 600 cocoa trees. All right. Out of 600, I can make probably 4 bags dry beans to sell. The way I look after it determines the production.
Are you surprised by the interest that you've seen in Australia to Bougainville chocolate?
I was surprised here because I did not know anything when I came to Melbourne, you know. I was surprised to see all this. You can make a lot of things with the dry beans, you know.
Yeah.
Chocolate, ice creams, and all sorts of things.
So my name's Andrew Campbell. I'm the Chief Executive of the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research, ACR.
What has ACR been doing with farmers in Bougainville?
For several years, we've been funding research led by University of Sydney on helping the cocoa growers of Bougainville to produce a more productive, even high-quality crop, better control of disease and so on. But then going further down the value chain, to try and ensure that they get a higher price for what are premium beans and that a bigger share of the retail price makes its way back to the growers.
You've brought some, helped bring some farmers from Bougainville to Melbourne to showcase their coffee. What was that?
Some of these farmers had never tasted chocolate before. They certainly hadn't seen how chocolate is made or what happens to their beans after they get them to the market. So helping them to understand the value chain, helping them to understand that there can be a premium for growing beans really well. That's all part of the objective here, but also to help the chocolate producers here in Australia to better understand the growers' perspective and to see if we can get that whole value chain working better for premium chocolate coming out of Bougainville, not just commodity confectionery.
My name's Leaping Munro. I'm founder and creator of Jasper and Myrtle Chocolates, and together with my partner Peter Channels, we're Jasper and Myrtle Chocolates, and we make chocolates from bean to bar, and we only use Bougainville cocoa beans.
We're standing in front of rows of different types of chocolate. We've got three of your types of chocolate. Maybe I'll try some and you can explain what I'm trying to the audience.
Okay. I've got three different chocolates that we have made with beans from Stephen Savarke. Stephen and Elizabeth Savarke are winners of the 2018 Bougainville Chocolate Festival. So what happens is they got their beans sent to seven different chocolate makers, and we were allowed to make any chocolate we wanted to showcase the beans.
Well, let's try that one first then. So I've grabbed a piece of the Jinduya.
Jinduya.
I brought you in my mouth. I'm being rude and talking while I eat, which you're not allowed to do. It has, as you say, a very smooth texture.
Mm-hmm.
You can taste the gentle flavour of the hazelnut,
mm-hmm.
but I guess the dominant flavour is still that rich cocoa from Bougainville.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it pairs beautifully with Stephen and Elizabeth's beans. The hazelnuts are only slightly roasted so that they don't overpower the cacao.
Do you think that there's a maturing taste in chocolate in Australia, and that might open up markets for more artisanal beans and producers from places like Bougainville?
Definitely. Not only is there a maturing taste for chocolate, there is also increased awareness and an increased willingness of consumers in trying to find out where their food comes from, where the ingredients are sourced, and a real hunger for understanding the processes, the sources, the ingredients, everything about the product that has a story. Everyone's very happy with finding things out like that.
It becomes a lot more than just about gardening. And we sit down and we exchange ideas and we talk about gardening, we talk about life.
Tucked away among gum trees on a block of land just outside Port Macquarie's town centre on the New South Wales mid-north coast, this community garden is flourishing. And it's not just the herbs and veggies that are thriving. Hi, I'm Emma Siossian, and I'm taking a stroll through the garden with President Graham Evans. He says this plot of land has become a social hub for the local community, where young and old come together.
Lots of people move into Port Macquarie, and we've attracted maybe 20 new members in the last month who have moved into Port Macquarie, and they come down here because they want to connect with people and they don't know anyone in the area. So this is a very good place to come if you don't know anyone, because we're very friendly and everyone's sitting down having a cup of tea now. People bring in homemade kombucha. I normally make pizzas. Other people bring in scones and things. And we sit down and we exchange ideas and we talk about gardening, we talk about life. Here, I meet people who are farmers, mothers, massage therapists, yoga people, Chinese medicine alternatives, all sorts of different things. And just ordinary people who come in here and don't have a garden necessarily themselves. They live in flats, and this is a chance for them to come and grow some food and enjoy company of other people.
Graham says artwork in the green space is also flourishing. Sculptures sit amid the rows of herbs, and a colourful tile mosaic has just been completed around a large pizza oven in the middle of the garden. Freshly picked tomatoes and herbs garnish tasty wood-fired pizzas, which come out of the creatively decorated oven.
The mosaic was an idea right from the start. Many of the people involved in the first committees had the dream of this being a place of art, as well as a place of nature. And we have lots of sculptures and things around the place that show that previous artistic efforts have gone into this place. But the mosaic was always a long-term dream. Until we had the roof on the pizza oven, it wasn't very practical to work there because it was very hot. And in fact, the artists decided to actually work at home on concrete plaster boards to avoid that difficult problem of having to stand in the sun and glue and so on.
And it's a beautiful mosaic which captures a bit of nature in it. Tell me a little about it.
Well, Chris Wilkinson, Jan Dennis and Kerry Wilden were the three artists who came up with the creative ideas. They had a look at the space and they had a look around here, and it was no coincidence that a few butterflies flew by at that time, and they came up with the idea of having four local butterflies incorporated into the design. Which is a great idea, and it really suits the garden to have that kind of natural theme there.
Oh, it's beautiful. I've seen some butterflies flying around as I walk around this morning.
And a few cabbage moss that we don't want.
Yeah, that's right. And it's great to see there's so many people here. We're here at a working bee morning, and there's people everywhere, young and old.
Thursday, we encourage parents to bring their kids along. We have a kids area over there with a sand pit. We have a new climbing area for them in there. So parents are encouraged to bring their kids on Thursdays. We normally have pizza, but we're waiting for the mosaic to actually settle down a little bit before we do that again.
I'm Jackie. I enjoy coming to the garden because the children get to interact with nature and plants, and they get to do a lot of free play, and it's good for the mums and the dads as well to have a bit of a catch up and enjoy the garden.
My name is Claire, and I like coming to the garden to feel part of the community while also getting your hands dirty and contributing to something larger, and then at the end of the day having a cup of tea and having some fresh vegetables.
At the moment, there are plenty of fresh vegetables to harvest and share, with the garden looking good this autumn.
We have tons of snake beans. We're standing right next to some at the moment. It's an interesting tropical bean. Grows much better here than some of the other beans when the weather's really hot.
And they're really long, aren't they?
Really good in Thai cooking, really good in stir fries, really good in fish cakes, all sorts of ways of using them. Yeah. We've got lots and lots and lots of herbs. Our turnips are now starting to come good. We've had tons of eggplant, tons of tomatoes, lots and lots of spinach, lots of greens, lots of Asian greens at the moment.
I must say, things are looking pretty good after the hot summer we've had.
Well, if you'd come here a month ago, the garden was under such stress, as everybody's gardens were. And, of course, we're now heading towards water restrictions because the dam levels are approaching the magic 70% number too.
Mm.
We use recycled water here.
So that rain's really come at a good time.
It has really helped, but we need more.
Absolutely.
Please go and organise garden parties or weddings or whatever it takes to make it rain. That's what we really need.
Graeme Evans, president of the Lost Plot Community Garden at Port Macquarie on the New South Wales mid-north coast. He was speaking with reporter Emma Siossian. You're listening to A Big Country with me, Serena Locke. And still to come, scientists hanging from ropes in the name of research as they study the rainforest canopy. And we'll join serving and former Defence Force members abseiling and rock climbing and supporting their mates.
Step into the leg loops. Stepping into a pair of shorts. Hitch it up nice and high.
Good to know.
Buckled in and ready to descend. Good luck.
Thanks very much. I remember the famous last words. It was don't look down.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. That was the tip, wasn't it? Don't look down.
Yeah.
So don't do it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Former Air Force member Dee Lowry is preparing to abseil down the steep rocks at Launceston's Cataract Gorge. Hi, I'm Fred Hooper. I'm here with Dee and other serving and former Defence Force members taking part in rock climbing and abseiling in northern Tasmania. But this is no military exercise. The aim here is mateship and taking on a physical challenge. This event has been organised by Mates for Mates, a support group for current and former Defence Force personnel who are wounded, injured or ill as a result of their service.
I'm not really sure what to expect today. I know that we're doing some rock climbing and some abseiling, but I haven't been to this location before, and it's been a long time since I've done any abseiling at all.
So what's your link to Mates for Mates?
I've been involved with Mates for Mates now for about 3 or 4 years. I was in the Air Force for nearly 23 years, so I find them a really good support organisation just to help me manage my injuries and keep in touch with other mates. And I just find that they're really good for my mental health, and they're a non-judgmental, really good group to be involved with.
And in a way, does Mates for Mates kind of replicate what you had or part of what you had in the military?
The rivalry side of things, definitely. There's always somebody, you know, to look out for you, I guess, check that you're going okay, check in with you. But a lot of the time, the activities that we do, it's just good to catch up with people and talk about things that aren't anything to do with the military, actually.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Oh, right.
Or the life that we left behind.
Yeah, so it's nice to get away from it too.
Yeah, it is. It's great to have that common ground. We all get it, and we're all experiencing a different journey, I guess, but there's people that understand as well. So it's good to just get together and shoot the breeze or come and do activities like this.
Jump off a cliff.
That sort of thing, exactly.
Sorry, did you say you were still in the military or you were in the military? No,
I was in the military. Yeah. I left on a medical discharge in February
2018. Okay.
Yeah.
Were you sad to leave?
No, not at all. I was quite glad to leave. I'd had enough of the system.
So it's probably a good time for you then?
Yeah, good time. This is about moving forward and learning to accept that I've got injuries now and some mental illness, and so it's about moving forward and trying to get on with my life.
How hard is that to explain to people who have not experienced any military lifestyle?
I find it really difficult because a lot of people just don't understand what we even do in the military, and especially being a woman, sometimes people think that a woman doesn't do soldiering of any kind, and so they kind of look at you and go, oh, well, you look fine. Why? What injuries do you have? Then I find people tend to get a bit intrusive. So I just choose the level of information that I decide to share with people.
So do you like talking about your injuries or not at all? You want to stay away from that?
Well, it's been a bit of a journey, and I have learnt to start talking about my injuries because I think it helps with the acceptance process.
And so when people ask you, you're kind of getting a little bit less... Or are you getting a little bit more open, I suppose, about that?
Yes, I am. Yeah. Yep. Especially with the stigma with PTSD. I have a diagnosis of PTSD, anxiety and depression. Mm-hmm. And once upon a time, I would never have said that out loud because I was not comfortable with even saying that to myself. Now, it just tends to roll off my tongue and I go, oh, well, it is what it is. Let's just deal with it and move forward.
What was it like when you first said those letters to yourself?
Oh, very scary, very vulnerable. I felt very vulnerable and I just didn't ever think it could happen to me. I thought it was something that happens to everybody else. I'd spent my career helping everybody else and I was quite surprised to find that I was actually susceptible to having that happen to me.
When are you going over the edge here?
Oh, I think we're going soon.
You got your helmet on, you got your gear on.
I'm dressed and I'm ready to go. So I think we're about 5 minutes away. I'll probably let somebody else go first.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm a little nervous, but I'll be good.
Matt Jenkins is the Mates for Mates liaison officer who has helped organise today's events. Matt says there's a couple of aims that they hope to achieve.
One of them would be a bit of social connection. So just putting like-minded people together. So not everybody in the group today knows each other and met each other before. There's a couple that have, and instantly just everyone kind of picks up on where people are and understand that. But also, I suppose the physical side is more of a giving people a challenge to go for. So we let them know that this was going to come up. Some people have some injuries, whether that be physical or psychological, and some hurdles to get over. And that gives them just a small opportunity to go, hey, I want to come and do this activity. I need to work on a few little things first, whether that be, you know, like classic example for knees and ankles, can get themselves to the physio and what they need to do, and then to come out here and have a good day and actually push themselves past where they would have been a few months ago.
How long does it take to see a change in somebody when they take part in an activity like this?
Depending on the individual and where they are in their circumstances. For some other people, we might get a phone call or a message a few weeks later and be like, actually, you know what, that really took me out of the slump that I was in. Mm-hmm. But generally, it's within a few weeks, I would say, yeah.
We're all clear.
Back at the cliff face, Dee Lowry has made it down to the base.
How'd you go there down the bottom now?
Yeah, it was good. The hot tip of don't look down was quite helpful. I found it a little bit hard on my hips as I was coming down, but otherwise, yeah, it was good. And I'm glad I've done it. Now that I'm looking back up, definitely worthwhile doing.
Walking through this rainforest, there's more than just branches and leaves overhead. Hanging from ropes suspended 50 metres above the ground, scientists are taking turns peeking into the canopy of five giant strangler fig trees. Hi, I'm Megan Kinnanmit, here on the ground walking through the forest at Mary Cancross Scenic Reserve near Mullaney in the Sunshine Coast hinterland. The scientists' observations from the very top of the tree will help give them an indication of the health of the forest. It's part of a big biodiversity study underway here, known as a BioBlitz. Coordinator Liz Kaplan explains.
The BioBlitz is mainly a biodiversity study of strangler figs in the rainforest at Mary Cancross Reserve. But beyond that, it's an event where lots of scientists, artists and members of the public are coming together to share their knowledge and to build their knowledge. We have seven main scientific teams, and some of them have a single person and some are groups, and they're all looking at different taxa groups. So we've got entomologists who look at insects, mycologists who look at fungi, botanists who everyone knows looks at plants, so a whole lot of different types of living things being studied.
We're in the middle of the forest here, walking down the path. Where are we headed?
So this track will lead us to the first of the survey figs, which is called Guria, which is a Dinnambara word for fig tree.
And each of the five figs were given Indigenous names?
Yes. Uncle Noel Blair, along with other Dinnambara elders, looked at the trees that were selected for the study and chose names for them all. So there's five, and if we walk in a circuit around the path, we'll meet all of them. So each tree, as most people would know, has a beautiful crown of leaves at the top, and we call that the canopy crown. And if you imagine a circle being drawn around that canopy crown going all the way down to the ground, we call that the drip line radius. All of the raindrops that fall from the canopy form the survey site that we're going to draw a circle around and find out everything that's living within that survey circle. We need to know what's in them so that we can actually have data to record whether something might be growing in numbers, whether something might be declining in numbers, whether the stratification of the species and where they're found might be changing.
My name's Dr. Jen Sanger and I'm an epiphyte ecologist.
I understand this is not the first time you've been up a tree, is it, Jen?
No, I've climbed quite extensively. For my PhD, I was studying epiphytes, which are plants that grow on the canopy of other trees. And in order to study them, I had to learn how to climb trees so I could access the canopy and go check them out.
How far up do you go?
Most of the time, the plants that I want to look at, the epiphytes, so the ferns and the orchids, are growing right up into the crown of the tree. So I need to climb up as high as possible to be able to see these species.
Is it usual for scientists to have to add those kind of skills to do their work?
It's a really interesting field, canopy ecology. Back in the past, maybe like 30 years ago, there was hardly anybody studying the canopy because there was still so much on the ground that we hadn't even, you know, checked out, I guess. The canopy in the 70s and 80s started to become this, what they called the last biological frontier. It was this realm that was out of reach, but there was a whole bunch of other like plants and animals that live up there. And also too, that's where most of the photosynthesis happens in the forest, is up in the canopy. And so scientists were really keen to get up there and study what was living up there. So the first couple of techniques that they tried to get up there was that some scientists actually trained monkeys to run up into the tree to collect orchids and ferns and to bring them back down. But obviously that has a limitation. So then tree climbing was kind of developed for research purposes, was developed by a few people maybe in the early 80s. And it's just a kind of a adaption to similar systems that they use in cave explorations. Okay. So you have a single rope and you have like an ascender that you climb up that rope. And now it's not super widespread, but it is becoming more and more popular. They've used big crane systems and big towers and even hot air balloons in the past to be able to access.
Hot air balloons?
Yeah, giant hot air balloons that have this kind of fold-out kind of like a tarp that sits on the top of the canopy with little holes cut in it so researchers can stick their hands down and collect leaves. It's quite a unique way.
It sounds also quite risky.
Oh, look, I guess it's because it is such an unusual thing. People assume that there's a lot of risk involved, and there is, to be honest, but if you are trained well and you know what to look for and you always double check things and you're always safe, it's pretty foolproof.
Dr. Jennifer Sanger, a canopy ecologist climbing trees in the Mary Cancross Scenic Reserve on the Sunshine Coast. And that report from Megan Kinnamont. And that's the show for today. For more information about all the stories you've heard, you can go to our website, abc.net.au/radionational, and you'll find A Big Country under the Program tab. I'm Serena Locke. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.